We're discussing a difficult and sensitive topic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It is suicide within the law enforcement ranks and first responder profession. Let's begin by acknowledging the fact that if you or anyone you know is struggling with depression or suicidal thoughts, help is available through the National Suicide Prevention Hotline 24/7. That number is 800-273-8255. Again, 800-273-TALK. Last year, a record high number of police officers died by suicide, according to a Massachusetts nonprofit that works to reduce the stigma of mental health issues. Are you a police officer or first responder? How do you handle the stress on the job? You're welcome to join the conversation with what you've experienced at any point. Our number here is 800-642-1234. Amanda Bates has been a paramedic firefighter in Burlington since 2014. She's also the conference and education director of the Wisconsin EMS Association. Amanda, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning, Kate. Thank you for having me.
Aaron Wonserski is also here. Aaron is video game outreach director at the Center for Suicide Awareness that is based in Kakana. And prior to that, Aaron worked for 12 years as a police officer, including 9 with the Fox Valley Metro Police Department. Aaron, welcome to you.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Amanda, let's start with you. I understand that when you were training to be a paramedic that you went on a very stressful call. Can you walk us through what happened?
Sure. So when I was in paramedic school, we had to do clinical rotations and also ride-alongs. My ride-along was with a bigger city service, and we responded to an unknown medical call. It seemed really routine. We're en route. We had the dispatch information. They didn't know what the medical emergency was. So that's kind of like all hands on deck. We just grab, it could be nothing. It could be something. And it wasn't what we thought it was going to be. It was much more severe and much more, damaging. It took the life of a 16-year-old, boy at his neighbor's home. So when we arrived on scene, we found a young man on the floor covered in water and the homeowner who didn't speak English. So as our crew decided what we were going to do and what we were going to do in this situation, I could just hear one of our crew members talking to the homeowner and trying to get some information out of him, like what happened, how did we get here? They just couldn't communicate with each other while we tried to save this young man's life on the floor of her home. I was completely covered in water and no idea why. I was young at the time. It was hard.
I wonder, Amanda, did you go on a call after that? Did you go back to work?
I did. I went, finished my shift that day, and then went to my normal EMS job the next day and the next day and back to school and graduated. And it just
meanwhile,
stayed with you.
Yeah. Meanwhile, what happened in this home continued to be, I'm sure, haunting you on your mind. Did any of your colleagues acknowledge or talk about it?
No. I mean, when I went through school, that was not something that you did. You didn't talk about the call. You might have talked a little bit about the call, about your skills or, you know, how quick you were able to get the intubation or how fast you were to get the line, but you didn't talk about the way the call made you feel, or some of the horrific or tragic incidents that happened on the call. You just didn't do that.
Aaron, for you, when you were a police officer, what was the stress like for you on the job, especially when you were starting out?
When you start out, you are very much excited. You're ready to learn all sorts of new stuff, and you don't really take in that stress because it's all new and exciting. I think the stress kind of compounds, you know, day after day after day. And what happens is you start to kind of integrate yourself with everything is negative. Everything just kind of, nothing is good. Nobody ever calls the police for anything good. So when you start compounding yourself with that, you don't recognize this underlying stress that's going to be taking a role in your life.
So what about the adrenaline rush of going out on these calls? How did you manage that, Aaron?
There's two thoughts of that. When you first start out, the adrenaline rush is fantastic. It's something, your training kicks in, and it's just something that is just flowing through you. And you get done with your call, you can decompress for a couple minutes, but then you're looking for your next adrenaline rush, whatever that is, you know. But then as you keep going down that road, it just starts to become so routine. And that adrenaline rush keeps going down and down and down, but you're still ready to go with everything. It just is not as prevalent as it usually was.
We're talking about mental health among police and firefighters this hour, and we're talking with Aaron Wanerski there, who was a police officer for 12 years. Amanda Bates, a veteran paramedic here as well. You can join in with your experiences about the pressures of being a first responder and how you cope at 800-642-1234. And let's bring in Barb Bigelke, who is Executive Director of the Center for Suicide Awareness based in Kaukauna. Barb, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having us.
You founded the Center for Suicide Awareness. What inspired you to start working with first responders?
I did found the Center for Suicide Awareness, and it came from my work as the executive director for the crisis response team, where we saw firsthand, working shoulder to shoulder with first responders, on the need of the resilience and, like Aaron said, the day-to-day, back-to-back calls that really plays on the mental health of the first responder.
So when you have these calls day-to-day, back-to-back, you're the first one on the scene, and it could be anything, as Amanda pointed out. What are the risks there that these first responders have in their line of work in terms of their mental health?
Well, you're dealing with calls, like Amanda was saying, that are trauma-based. Aaron also said, you don't call police or fire for good calls. You call them because you're in crisis. And it's when you have that back-to-back experience of it being a car accident, being at a suicide, being at some kind of crisis call, you really don't have time to continually refresh, get back to your center. And that weighs heavily on mental health, and now compound it year after year after year.
Let's bring in a perspective from Tanner, who is joining us from Sturgeon Lake this morning. Hi, Tanner.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. What was your situation?
Right. Yeah. Well, I'm not a first responder nor a police officer, but my dad was a sergeant for the police department for a long time. And my entire childhood, I listened to his stories, listened to literally everything that happened when he'd get home from work. I'd be up at about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, get my glass of milk and, you know, going to the bathroom. And he'd tell me what happened on those nights. And in 2018, December 17th, he passed away from alcoholism. And I just think that if that was addressed in the suicide tally, it would be much more, even more than the record that's already unfortunately been set. It's just kind of a thing that I see not only in him, but in his colleagues. And it was really sad because when you tried to talk to him, there was a bit of like pride and they didn't want to seem weak. And it really, I don't know, it took a toll on me when I was a kid, just kind of seeing it unfold.
Seeing it firsthand.
I can only imagine what they're going through on a day-to-day basis and feeling like they got to keep it all, you know, bound up inside. Because there was a point where my dad, he had to go on paid administrative leave for, it was about a year.
Well, Tanner, we have to pause here, and I really appreciate you bringing this. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, please be aware that we're talking about a difficult and sensitive subject, that is suicide among first responders. Please take care. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And although the statistics on law enforcement suicide are limited, there is a growing body of research. According to the Police Executive Research Forum, nationally, the risk of suicide among police officers is 54% greater than among American workers in general. And that's a report from last year. Have you lost an officer to suicide in your department? How did it get handled? What changes did your agency make? How are you holding up in responding to emergencies, especially in this pandemic, especially amid police brutality protests? It's 800-642-1234. Barb Bogelke and Aaron Wanzerski are with the Center for Suicide Awareness in Kaukauna. Amanda Bates is a paramedic firefighter and with the Wisconsin EMS Association. They stay with us. Amanda, I want to ask you about Tanner's situation and seeing Tanner's father take to alcoholism, and maybe that was a source of where Tanner's father was able to handle just what was happening on the job.
I want to offer my condolences to you, Tanner, and to your family. That is, I'm so sorry. That is horrible to hear that. It is, unfortunately, a trend for first responders to hide those emotions, to pack those feelings away, and then to use other behaviors to kind of cover that, you know, whether that be shutting down and not communicating with your family, whether that be drinking, whether that be chasing another form of adrenaline, whether it just compounds so much that they don't let it out. I have friends who, you know, fight with their wives or going through a divorce, they're systematically like picking apart their life because they just haven't been able to deal with the stress of the job. And it's really unfortunate. We see good, young EMS professionals deciding that this is not the profession for them because they can't deal and no one has trained them to deal with the things that they see and that they hear on a day-to-day basis. And it is really unfortunate. In the fire service, we pre-plan every single building in our community. We know the exit routes. We know the egress. We know what is contained in that building, how many people. We know the occupancy, but we don't know how to make ourselves resilient and sustainable. We don't talk about provider well-being. We spend half an hour in our initial education talking about lifting techniques and maybe not eating that second donut, but we don't talk about anything else. And it's really unfortunate. And I'm really sorry to hear that, Tanner.
Aaron, what would you like to add here? Because police officers work with guns. Does this play a role in the risk of suicide?
I think it does. However, again, I also want to offer my condolences to Tanner because I could see exactly what he saw. I see that in me at one point where, you know, alcoholism does play a role. And when you use that as a coping mechanism, it becomes toxic not only for you, it becomes toxic for your family, and it becomes toxic for your work family as well. And Amanda is so right. We never got a substantial amount of resiliency training or any sort of training on how to deal with those emotions. It's very much a, you know, you go into this role, it's the quote unquote, you know what you signed up for. And you have to somehow manage that and find a way that's, quote, healthy to deal with it. But there isn't an outlet like that, like the resiliency training that we've got.
We're talking with Aaron Wanzerski with the Center for Suicide Awareness, Barb Bogelke, who is executive director, and veteran paramedic Amanda Bates, also with us as we look at suicide among police officers and firefighters and what can be done to cope with the acute stresses in this line of work. Let's bring in Beth now in Hudson. Hi, Beth.
Hi.
Hi. What's on your mind?
I've had this conversation quite a bit with people, and I think that the police in larger communities especially, but I'm sure maybe in the smaller ones too, that they need to be having some sort of a forced mental respite, a weekend, a week, or whatever, where they go into some deep PTSD therapy, and that it's paid, and that they cannot go to work the following week if they do not complete this respite, and because I know that when they're like basically in the war every day, and like that other guy said, that that it is all negative, and they're putting their life on the line every minute, and everything is volatile, and something could turn into a tragedy very fast. And well, that maybe empathy could be part of it, because I know that I'm both sides of the fence. And then also something's their family. If the family wanted to, needed some help, and maybe the stigma of it being a weakness can start to decline, you know?
So what I'm hearing, Beth, is taking a real holistic approach, and also Beth offering, you know, having to take some mental respite. Barb, tell us about these approaches and what your center is doing with first responders.
Absolutely. Beth touched on something about the stigma. We have a huge stigma that if we ask for help, we're weak. I think even Tanner mentioned that, and my condolences go to Tanner. There is nothing weak about asking for help. And the more we break that stigma and say, this is my well-being, instead of just saying, hey, I have to go do something, the center is doing a lot around, and I don't know if I want to call it holistic, but I want to say whole, as in W-H-O-L-E. We're a whole person. We're taking care of not only our physical, but our emotional, our mental, and spiritual. Our team was just recently certified in the FBI Academy for these type of resilience skill sets, and that is taking those respites, understanding our emotions, checking our thinking, and getting back to that ground where we are at our peak.
Erin, when you were in the department, was there attention given in the police academy to how to manage the stress load?
Not so much in the academy itself. Fox Valley Metro did a very good job with basically debriefing if there was a critical incident. And that was very good, especially on those major ones, because you get to talk it out. You get to kind of see everybody's perspective. But the one thing that wasn't common was these everyday ones. I mean, you can go to disturbances, domestics, and it could hit home in some way, but you're not going to process that with a sit down of everybody like you would with a suicide or some other major use of force scenario.
Mark from Black River Falls called to share that Mark is a Gulf War veteran, and Mark has learned it takes a strong person to ask for help and wants others to feel empowered to accept help and accept resources. Amanda, what would you say there in terms of being open to saying, look, I need some help?
Absolutely. I think first responders are having a very normal reaction to an abnormal situation. And once that statement and that mindset becomes normalized, I think then people will be able to talk about it. I know talking about feelings is tough, and people do not want to go there. But if you're affected by something, do yourself the favor and say it out loud, verbalize it, give it a name, and then leave it. Our people can't set it down. You know, we drive past the same locations, or we respond to the same house. Those memories will come back to you. They hit you in the shower. They hit you when you're with your family. I've had calls where we've taken an 8-year-old out of the backseat who was in a rollover accident, who wasn't strapped in the suitcase. I have a daughter. I think about that now almost every time I get into the vehicle. Check your seatbelt. I've had to pick up body parts along the side of a railroad after a suicide attempt. For a long time, I didn't even want to go near that intersection with the railroad tracks. You know,
I wonder, Barb, how do you help people through flashbacks?
Amanda's talking about real situations. Those are every day. And those flashbacks can come out of nowhere, like Amanda said. They can be in the shower. They can be when you're sitting down and having dinner. We don't plan for those flashbacks. And so really that's getting back down to the root of the trauma. What caused that? Did we process it in a healthy way? Erin touched upon, you know, having those times to debrief and actually process through it so it's not staying with you forever. And that's one of the things that we definitely work through, is identifying the trauma and then processing it and providing those coping skills that are positive, like we just talked about, you know, instead of turning to coping skills like alcoholism or other coping skills, we really focus on what coping skills do you have in your toolbox to help you through those traumas.
We're discussing the stress of the first responder profession and efforts to strengthen suicide prevention. Amanda Bates is a paramedic firefighter and an office holder in the Wisconsin EMS Association. Barb Bigalke there heads up the Center for Suicide Awareness in Kakana, and Erin Wansersky is an outreach director at the center. Has your department discussed fatigue, burnout, trauma? What is being done? Have you been an ear for your colleague when they needed it? What did you say? And where did you turn to when the stress on the job is unbearable? Join in at any point, 800-642-1234. We will be back to discuss suicide prevention efforts right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. You're with us as we discuss a very sad and difficult topic. It is death by suicide and the risk factors and prevention efforts among first responders, police officers, firefighters, EMTs. It's a conversation we're having here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. According to the Police Executive Research Forum, there's no central repository of information, so stigma, shame, and even denial continue to keep death by suicide in the shadows and keep some officers from seeking help that can help save lives. Are you a police officer or first responder? How do you handle the stress of the job? Do you think more attention to the mental health of officers might change how first responders approach their work? It's 800-642-1234. We have three voices with us. Barb Bigalke is executive director of the Center for Suicide Awareness, and Erin Wansersky is an outreach director at the center in Kakana. Amanda Bates is a paramedic firefighter in Burlington, and they all stay with us. Let's bring in Annette joining us from Madison now. Hi, Annette. What are your thoughts?
Good morning. Thank you so much for this conversation. I have two quick questions. One is I would like to know, what does the data show when it comes to differences of gender, racial, ethnicity, and the intersectionalities of these when it comes to the police and the firefighters? And as well, the next question would be, how does the police misconduct affect other police officers mentally? Thank you.
Barb, I'm going to have you field at least one of those, starting with, is there any data out there showing a breakdown on whether death by suicide among first responders is more prevalent among men or women?
You know, I think that's the need that we do have. There isn't enough data. For one, we know a lot of suicides go as accidental. I think Tanner even said, including his father's death, that was alcoholism. So the data is just not there. We don't do a good job of understanding what the impact is and that it could result into dying by suicide. So that data just isn't there. We just don't do a good job of tracking it.
Erin, I wonder if you would field Annette's insights there on whether the protests over police brutality, the Black Lives Matter protests, how that is affecting the mental health of first responders and police officers who are out there.
Absolutely. Full disclosures, I left policing before this movement really started. And I think there's a very plausible and great reasoning for this movement. But it's also shadowed by that every officer, every department is negative or that is doing something wrong. And that's just not the case, because with my departments that I worked with and the people that I worked with in surrounding agencies, couldn't be further from racist, couldn't be further from being trying to pick one person out. Everybody knows that they're there to do a job, and they're there to do it for that person that they're dealing with, regardless of race, color, anything. It didn't matter. And the one thing I will say with that, though, is when these things do happen, it does bring morale down because then everybody looks at you and says, oh, you're associated with them. You must be into that breakdown. And that's just not the case. And that's a very subjective thing to see.
But as you look closer at biases, how did it feel to, say, go to the same address again and again and have very negative negative feelings about what might be there within that call?
That is very true. You know, you do get called to the same house over and over and over, and it does start becoming more routine and saying, okay, you have to go deal with this situation again and again and again. And you start to let your guard down, and it doesn't necessarily make it right or wrong, but it's one of those things that you also have to recognize that they have a situation that they cannot control, and they're calling you for help. And you have to make sure that you are on top of your game all the time to make sure that you can fix that situation to make it right.
You know, Amanda, we've talked with you much earlier in the pandemic about what it is like to be a first responder and getting suited up and getting that PPE on. And I'm just wondering, as you look at the layers of the crises that we're facing here in our country, what is that like now to go out on calls?
We are still following the same protocols. We're still fully suiting up. If it's a tagged COVID location, if they have any symptoms of the flu, if they've been sick recently, we're still doing that with the added stress that some people don't believe that COVID-19 is real and that we could still bring it home to our families. It's just another layer.
Do you feel like because you've gone out and put that PPE on over and over and over again, is it feeling any more routine, or are you still feeling those same fears, those same what ifs? Is there any fatigue in there?
There's definitely fatigue. There's also information fatigue because it's coming at us everywhere, and there just hasn't been a consistent message. I think our medical directors play a large role in quelling some of the rumors. I just wish that the public would be more open to hearing from medical science.
Barb, talk to us about the resilience training that you're providing to first responders in Wisconsin. What skills are you trying to teach?
There's 12 actual skill sets. And I want to say that these are evidence-based. This isn't something that we just created. It is used in the military, and it is used, like we just said, certified through the FBI Academy. They are skill sets of simple things. Erin talked about going to the same house over and over. That skill set is checking your playbook. Have we showed up, even if we're showing up 10 times to the same address, at our best peak? And so it's an activity of saying, hey, check your playbook. Are you going back in with, we've been here before, or are we coming in as if this is the first call? So there's 12 exact skill sets. The biggest thing to remember, this isn't just a poster that you hang up in your office. These are skill sets that we want officers and first responders to retain. And so it's inward, outward, so that they're showing up at their peak.
How are officers and firefighters, how are they responding to the training?
Absolutely love it. We've had many a call from our first responders saying, yes, this is the exact kind of training that we need. So there definitely is the need. And so I think that goes piggyback on their, not only is the need, but there's a want that they want to show up at their best.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about mental health, wellness, suicide prevention among first responders. This hour, we're talking with the Center for Suicide Awareness. We have Barb Bukalki and Erin Wansersky. We also have Amanda Bates, who is a veteran paramedic. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Peter now in Viroqua. Hi, Peter.
Hi. How
Hi.
You doing?
Yeah, I understand you work in trauma-informed care.
Yeah. I've been trained by St. A in Milwaukee, and I do presentations mostly around Southwest Wisconsin where I live. Yeah.
What would you like to add?
I'm really aware that when I do my work that it's easy for me to have kind of an old mindset that I'm there to come in and fix a situation or fix a person. And we're really trying to take the data from the last 22 years around the effect of trauma on not only victims, but people in the helping profession, and move our perspective so that we're coming in with this perspective that we're there to help. And I think that there's some real strong data that shows that when we come in to help rather than to fix, then it leaves everyone with a safer feeling. It helps build trust. Sometimes when people come in trying to fix, then that can lead to uncertainty and doubt, and it can lead to maybe more confrontation.
Peter, thank you so much. Amanda, what do you make of that mindset, coming in to be help the situation and not coming in with a fix-it attitude?
Absolutely. I think if we could get these tools in the hands of first responders when they're first coming onto the job, we'll see more longevity and better, more meaningful careers.
How do you approach your mindset when you're going into an environment, going into a home?
I try to be the best version of myself every single time I show up. I use a term called show up and show out. I need to be the best version of myself for my patient and for my patient care, for my community. Every single run I go, every time I step foot on an ambulance, I'm giving 110% of myself, and I don't allow anything less than that. It is hard. I wouldn't say it's hard, but it is a lot of pressure, but rightfully so, because it's someone's life.
Barb, what do you make of that? Show up and show out.
Absolutely. And I want to circle back with Peter saying, you know, trauma-informed care is part of the resilience program. You're not going in because they're broken. You're coming in as what has happened. And having Amanda say that show up, you're showing up in a situation that isn't normal. Someone called because they're in crisis. And so showing up at their peak, that takes resilience. And that's, and I know Amanda, and yeah, you are showing up to be the best you possibly can for the person that you're treating.
Erin, how did you take on to the training? What did you take away from it?
I loved the training. One, and I'm not saying that because we're putting it on. I'm saying it as a previous first responder that, and Peter said it directly, perfectly, you're not going in to fix me, you're going to help me. And when you do that, it gives the first responder that sense of, okay, I can do this on my own, but it's still a tool to help them. And when I was able to learn these things and actually practice them in my daily life, I found my quality of life getting better.
We're talking with Erin Wansersky, who is an outreach director at the Center for Suicide Awareness. Barb Bogalke is executive director. And we're talking, and Amanda Bates, paramedic firefighter in Burlington, as we discuss the suicide prevention work and mental health of first responders. Still time for your insights, your situations, experiences, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation. And please be aware, it is difficult and sad. So please take care of yourself as we discuss first responder deaths by suicide. A record number of current or former police officers died by suicide last year. That's according to Blue Help, a national research and advocacy organization. The letters and HELP stand for Honor, Educate, Lead, Prevent. Amanda, I want to ask you for your insights on another story. I understand you recently lost a friend and a colleague to suicide, and I'm so sorry to hear that, but can you tell us anything about that person?
They were an amazing individual, so full of life, so funny, so much to give, long, long, incredible career in life ahead of them. The kind of personality to walk in the room and they would just own the climate. I'm just brilliant and funny. And it hurts that they didn't see that within themselves. And I don't know what demons they were battling or for how long. And it just sucks that our last conversation was basically an exchange of funny memes. You know, it wasn't even really any depth. And it's horrible to not have seen that or any inclination, you know, that was even something they were dealing with.
There were no signs.
It breaks my heart.
You didn't sense anything? No signs?
Absolutely none whatsoever.
Amanda, how much of a factor is burnout among paramedics, firefighters, other first responders?
We know that 37% of us will experience it on a regular basis. But it could be every day. You could have one call that just sets it off. You could go a week without feeling like you're burnt out. You can go one call and feel like you're burnt out. It's a lot. You're asking a lot of people who are more than willing to give it if there was, you know, something to be gave to them in return. And whether that be a safe space or some extra training. And you're right, we're not asking you to fix anybody. We're just asking for extra tools so we can help ourselves.
Barb, with the resiliency training and identifying traumas and confronting them, the issue that I see is that, you know, these are compounding traumas, that first responders are going to situations day after day, week after week, and so they're building up inside. How do you approach that?
You're right. You're taking it day by day. And how do you approach that is that after those calls that do produce trauma is that you're spending the adequate time to process those so that they're not lingering. I think what happens a lot of times is you go on a call and you're right back into the next call and the next call. So you don't know even which layer you're actually having to trauma on it. And so some of these skills is really sort of unpacking some of that and getting down to some of the root of it. Also, we have to remember that certain activities and events affect each other differently. One person going on a call might feel trauma. Amanda was saying when she went to a call, it resonated that she herself was a mom. And so those kind of things have to play in factors.
I wonder, Erin, you know, even when you hear the word training, you know, that immediately has its own connotations like, oh, training. Do you find that you have to get through those barriers that this training really matters, that it will make a difference and that everyone needs it?
I think you said it perfectly. When you hear the word training, I bet every first responder goes, oh, I can't, I don't want to do this. You have to accept it. You have to say, look, there is a problem that I'm having or my colleagues are having. Just open yourself up to this training. Open yourself up to the notion that you can be the best version of yourself. You just have to open yourself. And when you do that, you'll find that even just taking a little step forward is going to change your life for the better. And when you're able to do that, I can guarantee you that your family life, your work life, your friend life, everything gets so much better. Because you talk about burnout, I am the definition of that job. It was so hard to deal with it. And when I made the choice to leave, that was hard as well. But it was the right choice for me and my family.
When you left and you looked at that burnout, was there a pivotal point where you said, yes, this is too much. I have to change my career or change my focus. Was there a point?
I think towards the end, there was a lot of compounding things that were just playing a role into the whole burnout scenario. You know, internally, yeah, there's always going to be issues. But at the same time, when I take a step back and actually look at my life during that time, I wasn't good. I plain and simple, I wasn't the best I could be. And if I were to have this earlier in my career or have a skill set or a tool set that was able to kind of change my perspective on certain situations and calls I went on, I wonder if that would have been a different outcome. But I can't go back. I can't change it. All I can do is move forward and help the first responders that are out there every day putting their lives on the line, give them the tool set and give them the courage to speak up and say, look, it's okay to be weak and it's okay to talk about it.
Barb, the resiliency training includes a focus on gratitude as well. What is the purpose there of bringing gratitude into it?
It does. I think we've all been talking about the negativity that has come about. And in amongst the negativity, what we talk about is counting those blessings, hunting the good stuff, finding something that is one good thing and appreciating it. Even if it's simply somebody thanked me today, I think it goes to the back to the basics of if we're grateful for something, then it gives that breath of, hey, we can do this once again. So we do simple activities of putting a gratitude down and posting it on a wall. And so that you have a wall that's full of your gratitudes. And each time it gets deeper and deeper. It might be, hey, I had a great cup of coffee. And now you get down to a deeper level as we start to implement these skill sets that, hey, you know what? I got to go home and put my son to bed because I got home early. And that was a real gratitude. So it's going down to those depths of finding what is under all those layers.
Amanda, how has the gratitude training resonated with you?
I have enacted it every single day since we had the training in mid-July. It's my favorite part of the day to just lay in bed and reflect on three or four of the greatest things that's happened. I could have a bad day. I could be stuck in traffic. I could have gotten a speeding ticket. They could be sold out of my favorite coffee. But there's still always something good about that day. And to me, now it's just a habit. I look for the good.
You know, we're getting close to the end here of our conversation, and I'm wondering, first with you, Erin, is there anything you would like to leave us with on what we should be paying attention to more with mental health and first responders?
Yeah, I think we have to look at it saying that in today's climate, it is probably more challenging to be a police officer than ever, and I feel for them so much because they have so many things that they have to be doing. And they're under such scrutiny for it. The best thing I can ever tell somebody is they might be having a bad day. And the best thing that anybody could do to somebody is just, hey, say thank you for what you do. Because it's not an easy job. And to really pull back the veil and open yourself up is a hard thing to do. But when somebody says, thank you so much for what you did for me, you helped me with getting my car out of traffic, I guarantee you that that is a turning point in that person's day. Even if they don't see it, it is. Mm-hmm. And again, just thank you so much to all the first responders for what you're doing.
Amanda, any final thoughts?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, if you are feeling like you need to just say something, say it, man. Don't carry it with you. Put those bags down. It's okay. It's okay to say that was a messed up call or I don't know what's wrong with me. I'm just not feeling like myself today. It's totally fine. It's okay. Give yourself some space and please, God, be kind to yourself.
Well, thank you all for joining us. Amanda Bates has been a paramedic firefighter since 2014. She's also the conference and education director of the Wisconsin EMS Association. Erin Wansersky is the video game outreach director at the Center for Suicide Awareness. And prior to that, he worked for 12 years as a police officer. Barb Bogalki is executive director of the Center for Suicide Awareness. And if you or anyone you know is in crisis, help is available 24/7 through the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 800-273-8255. That's 800-273-TALK. Just ahead, it is 1 a.m. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.